A Life of Jesus by Brother Melva Purkis, Book 5, Chapter 1. Lessons in Discipleship. For many weeks, the cities of Israel heard the gospel of the kingdom and witnessed the power of God. Journeying in pairs through the land, the lowly men of Galilee spread abroad the fame of Jesus, nor did their master cease from his constant activity. He too, probably with other disciples who were later to take part in an even larger campaign, moved from place to place teaching and healing. Away to the south, in the great fortress of Machaerus, 4,000 feet above the eastern shores of the Dead Sea, an event occurred which altered the whole course of the Lord's ministry. The nobles and high military and civil officials of Galilee would have no suspicion of the significance of the occasion as they gathered from all parts of the province to the birthday feast which Herod Antipas had arranged. John, worn out with the privations and sufferings inevitable to his confinement, could not know that even his untimely death would play its part in the divine purpose that was slowly unfolding. Herod Antipas, like his father Herod the Great and his brother Archelaus, had little to commend him. Cruel, suspicious, and sensual, he stopped at nothing to satisfy his desires. During a visit to Rome, he'd fallen into an intrigue with Herodias. Neither the fact that she was the wife of his half-brother Philip, nor the inconvenience of his already having married the daughter of Aretas, king of Arabia, were allowed to stand in his way. He robbed his half-brother and repudiated his own wife, and brought Herodias to his throne. The new queen had never forgiven John for his condemnation of this incestuous union, and his imprisonment might have satisfied her but for one disturbing thing. There was something about this gaunt, fearless prophet which fascinated Antipas. Mark tells us unexpectedly that Herod feared John, knowing he was a righteous man and holy, and so kept him safe. And when he heard him, he was much perplexed and heard him gladly. Herodias could never be sure that John would not be pardoned and released, and so she watched carefully for the opportunity finally to silence him. The great banquet is at its height in the brilliantly lit hall of his fortress. Wine has flowed freely. The moderate shouts of laughter echo through the building, and coarse jests abounded. Debauchery is in the air. The dissolute king seeks fresh excitement for his guests, and with depraved familiarity he calls for his stepdaughter Salome to quicken their drunken senses. They watch her sensual movements with delight. The exhibition is over, and intemperate voices roar acclaim. Antipas, his vanity flattered, rouses himself from his stupor. "She shall be rewarded for this," he shouts loudly, "to the half of my kingdom." He utters an oath. This is too much for the girls to decide. She must find her mother. And a slow smile of triumph lights the evil, beautiful features of the queen. Her opportunity has come. The head of John the Baptist. Salome stands once more before the king, and he suddenly sobers as he hears her words. A half-shocked, half-guilty hush falls on the scene. He searches the faces of his guests, the grandeur of their attire contrasting with their bemused and stupid faces. He thinks of the strange, silent man in the darkness of the dungeon and feels a great remorse. But the oath, it must be done. Mark records, immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. John's few remaining disciples went sadly to the castle and bore the headless body away. Reverently they buried it and went northward to tell Jesus the tragic news. Thus died this rugged man of God as he had lived, with a grandeur of purpose and a moral dignity unequalled among the children of men. The widespread propagation of the gospel extended the whole scope of Christ's ministry. It would cause no little anxiety to the scribes and Pharisees, who saw it bursting out into a national ferment with far-reaching political consequence. Reports would reach Jerusalem, and even the lordly Sadducees would be stirred. While the zealots, that intensely patriotic minority, would wait hopefully for some sign of open revolt. The Passover was near at hand. Could it be that with a million fervent Jews around the city, the Messiah would march southward and strike for freedom against the Roman oppressor? Herod Antipas, in the remoteness of his castle, heard and feared for both personal and national reasons. It may appear strange that the king had not heard of Jesus before this, that he had not received reports of the multitudes that had been drawn by his teaching from every corner of the land, and of the miracles that he was continually performing. But there are two probable reasons for this. Herod was a man who cared little for the people. He was out of touch with their needs and activities. His whole time was devoted to keeping his relations right with Rome and giving his pleasures and ambitions as much satisfaction as his ample means and power would allow. It's also possible that Antipas had not been in Galilee since Jesus had begun his active ministry there. It is true that he had a palace at Tiberias, but he spent much of his time at his two strongholds in Perea, at Julius and at Machaerus. The murder of John the Baptist seems to have had a profound effect upon Herod. A melancholy descended upon him which left him restless and superstitious. When he heard of this preacher in Galilee surrounded by vast crowds and doing unbelievable miracles, his conscience smote hard. "It's John whom I beheaded. He is risen from the dead." But Herod did nothing about it. Later on during his ministry, some Pharisees were to tell Jesus that Herod sought his life. But it seems to have been their own effort to alarm him and drive him away, rather than any active hostility on the part of Herod. The day was coming when, with Jesus standing before him, he would have a wonderful opportunity of atoning for his miserable betrayal of John. But he only descended further into the abyss. He mocked the bridegroom, as he had mocked his friend, and allowed his soldiers to disport themselves. We can find no pity in our hearts for Herod when we learn that his future held nothing but disgrace. He was deprived of his kingdom and spent his last days in exile, and at last he went unto his own place. The tragic tidings from the Dead Sea seem to have coincided with the return of the 12 to Capernaum. They'd come back full of glowing reports of all that they'd achieved in his name. The city itself was full of activity as the news spread that Jesus was in their midst and the apostles had returned from their long mission. But with the death of John, Jesus must have felt more than ever the grim reality of the cross, the resentment of the priests in Jerusalem and the mounting opposition of the scribes in Galilee. And these have cast its shadow across his path. But now words had changed to deeds. The forces of evil had struck, and righteous blood had flowed. The staunch prophet of the desert, whose life's work had been to prepare the people to receive him, lay murdered. From this time, the tenor of Christ's ministry changed. Capernaum hardly saw his gracious figure in her streets again. The multitudes found him demanding an allegiance they were loath to give, and many drifted away. On every possible occasion, he showed a desire to get his disciples alone privately, so that he could reveal to them progressively, as they were able to bear it, the true course of his life and the nature of his death. And so it was now. He led them away from the busy city down to the lakeside, where their long-neglected fishing boats lay, tugging quietly at the moorings. "Come ye yourselves apart unto a desert place, and rest a while."